Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and unrehearsed, Information Please continues on its wayward path tonight. Our board of experts consists of our two regulars, John Kieran of the New York Sun and Franklin P. Adams, and our two guests, John Mason Brown, Lieutenant, United States Naval Reserve, now on inactive duty, and author of the bestseller, Many a Watchful Night, and Dr. Robert Cushman Murphy, Chairman of the Department of Birds of the American Museum of Natural History. And we're going to begin with a question from Myra Brown of New York City. She wants you to get 2 out of 3 on this. Can you name a member of the animal kingdom other than man that has a beard? Any animal other than man that has a beard? Mr. Brown.
A goat.
A goat has a beard. Dr. Murphy, is there any other?
An orangutan.
Has an orangutan a beard? At what
excellent.
Age?
Excellent.
Excellent beard. At what age does it grow one?
Well, by the time it's mature male, it has a good beard.
And when does an orangutan mature, if I'm not being too...
About 7 years.
7 years. Not lucky for the orangutan. And an animal, someone other than man, that has a mustache. A mustache. Think of any animal that has a mustache? Or one, Dr. Murphy?
Well, a walrus has an old Bill mustache.
Yes. Very much like that, as you say, like the old Bruce Bairnsfeather character. Doesn't a cat, the common Felis something or other, have a mustache, Mr. Kieran?
Felis domesticus. I don't know what it is. Well, you could call it a mustache, but it doesn't serve the same purpose at all. It doesn't strain coffee.
Well, what are you wanting to do, wax it? cat, seal, walrus. What member of the animal kingdom is bald, other than men? Mr. Adams.
An eagle.
The bald eagle is bald. Dr. Murphy, would that be right?
Looks bald.
You're
really
kind of...
well feathered, but a vulture is, as a rule, bald. A condor is bald.
Would you admit Mr. Adams is bald-headed eagle?
Well, I think that's a euphemism, such as Mr. Adams is apt to use.
he's not only apt to use it, he does use it. Well, yes, vultures are usually bald. You say condors. How about this one from William F. Haddock of New York City? Again, get 2 out of 3. This is a question about plays. Identify the play in which an important scene occurs on this holiday. The first is Thanksgiving. There's an important scene in a play, and it occurs on Thanksgiving. Mr. Adams.
The late George Apling.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Adams. Which act is it? Is it Act 2? In which the... Mr. Brown?
It's Act 1 with the carryover. They go in for dinner.
Oh, yes. And come out looking very replete and...
And then you hear that they've eaten.
Yes. Now, what play has a scene which occurs on Christmas Eve? Not running at the moment, but within recent memory. An important scene occurs on Christmas Eve. Mr. Brown, I'm positive that...
It's,
Mr. Adams again.
The Fortune Hunter.
Do you have me there, Mr. Adams? I don't know the Fortune
Maybe
Hunter.
Turn to the Right. It's one of those things that's on Christmas Eve.
Turn to the Right had a sort of a Christmassy
and,
atmosphere.
And
snow
they have
and
a poker game on Christmas Eve.
Don't confuse this with your personal life, Adams.
They married something else.
Now, you may be right. The one I was thinking of, Mr. Kieran, did you have one?
No, I don't know.
Mr. Brown?
It's the one I was thinking of, if I may be totally wrong, was one of Philip Barry's plays. And it's either Parents Bound or Holiday, and I can't quite at the moment remember. There's a Christmas scene.
Well, now you have me there.
And there was one Dear Octopus, I think, had a Christmas scene, right?
But it may be so. Your memory is far better than mine on plays, Mr. Brown, as well as on many other things. I was thinking of The Man Who Came to Dinner, which has that famous scene in which Sheridan Whiteside gives that radio address to the little... about the little tots as the heartbreaking radio.
And the convicts.
Yes, that's
and
the one.
And Fireboys, rather than
that. That's right. Now, there is another play, this belongs more or less to the classic repertory, in which an important scene occurs on Easter. In fact, the play opens, I think. Mr. Kieran?
Oberammergau,
The Oberammergau Passion play? Now, does that have an Easter scene, Mr. Brown?
It does.
It does indeed. That would be one. Goethe's Faust, does it not? Part One has a scene laid at Easter, Mr. Brown?
Then there's Strindberg's Easter.
I never read it. Does it? Has it anything to do with Easter?
Yes.
Well, that settles it. Now we have three Easter plays. That gives us 3 out of 3 and passes us on to this question from Ben Aronson of Chicago. Can you identify these famous lines of poetry and translate them? I'll give them to you in the original language, butchering them, doubtless. You have to get all on this. Quidquid id est timeo danaos et dona ferentes. Well, I have two hands. Mr. Adams.
Fear the Greeks bearing gifts.
Yes, you've got the last three quarters of the line quite right. The first part, quidquid id est, Mr. Kieran.
Well, quidquid id est timeo danaos et dona ferentes. That gives the caesural pause in there. Whatever it may be, I fear the Greeks bringing gifts.
Good heavens, did I leave out the caesural pause, Mr. Adams?
No.
Never forgive myself. Yes, whatever it be, I fear the Greeks even when bringing gifts. And, Mr. Adams, that comes from?
Virgil.
From Virgil, yes. The Aeneid, Book 2. Doubtless Mr. Kieran could give us the line if I pressed him. Line 48. He does. I'd give it to you without being pressed. Now, the next is perhaps not an equally famous line. It's in French. Où sont les neiges d'antan? Mr. Brown.
That's Villon.
It is Villon, and it's from what? François Villon?
I thought I'd done well enough.
Can you give us the translation?
Well, the snows of yesterday.
Yes, that is Rossetti's translation, a very beautiful one. Mr. Kieran?
Do you like the whole thing in French?
Sure, I'd love a few lines of it. Can you give it to us?
Dites-moi où n'en quel pays est fort la belle Romaine, occupiade ne taïs qui fut sa cousine germaine, et qu'au parlant comme bruit ton main, and so on.
It almost sounds French, too.
He could go on, too. It is the, as Mr. Kieran and Mr. Brown remind us, from the famous Ballade des Dames du Temps Jadis of François Villon. And now the third and last of these famous foreign quotations. Lasciate ogni speranza, voi che entrate. Dr. Murphy.
It's from Dante's Inferno. I think it's the beginning of the fifth canto.
The
All third. Hope abandon, the third canto.
Third canto.
All hope abandon, ye who enter here.
Yes, that's quite right. I guess these are too familiar. We'll have to get some tougher ones next time. Try this from Mrs. Jesse Kurtz of New York City. Get 2 out of 3. How do these people traditionally react in these situations? How does a Samoan girl react to kissing? I'm not talking of wartime Samoa, but of pre-war Samoa. react to kissing, Mr. Adams.
He doesn't like it.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Adams. How did you know that?
Because I don't think you'd ask it otherwise.
Now, I thought that you had possibly been to Samoa, Mr. Adams. Yes, as a matter of fact, she reacts to it with disgust, with utter repulsion.
Who told you that?
It's in the books, Mr. Kieran. Have you had better luck in Samoa than Adams has? How did a Sicilian show that he accepted a challenge to a duel? A Sicilian show that he accepted a challenge to a duel. Now, this may be outmoded by this time. I don't know whether they do this now.
What, by leaving Sicily?
No. If you had seen an opera or heard an opera by Mascagni, you would know the answer to this question. What opera would you suppose?
Cavalleria.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Adam. Now, all you have to do is to invent the proper answer to this, and you're all right.
I don't know.
Oh, Mr. Adams, you disappoint me. And so rarely. Mr. Kieran?
Boy sent a song.
No.
Well, in the opera he does.
I think he does that after he bites the challenger's ear, which is a Sicilian method of showing that you accept a challenge to a duel.
That's mayhem.
It seems to me the duel is practically over by that time, Brown. Well, I got that one wrong. Now, how did a well-bred Melanesian behave toward his mother-in-law? Now, why should you know this? Gentlemen, Dr. Murphy.
With great deference.
How do you know that?
That's the only report I've ever had from Melanesia.
Well, now, they've cleaned up the reports for your benefit, Dr. Murphy, because in Melanesia, a well-bred Melanesian strictly avoids his mother-in-law.
Well, that's treating her with great deference.
Well, now, you have just lost the mother-in-law vote, Dr. Murphy, in one fell swoop. Well, I don't think it really is treating it with great deference. It's in Melanesia and Polynesia and those sections of the world, there's a widespread mother-in-law taboo. You never see your mother-in-law, presumably.
There used to be that in Vaudeville.
Well, you still have a sort of a joke hangover of it, don't you, Mr. Brown? I don't think I can quite accept that answer, Dr. Murphy.
Give her the dough.
Oh, I'd give her the dough. $57 to Mrs. Church, winning a set of the Britannica.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, while the experts are recovering their wits after kicking that one around, here's a bit of music.
This one comes from Mrs. J.M. Smith of Detroit. Get 2 out of 3. Can you quote a line of poetry that includes these phrases, all of which deal with rapture? The first is careless rapture, a line of poetry that has the phrase careless rapture in it. Mr. Kieran.
That's the wise thrush who sings each song twice over, lest you should think he never could recapture that first fine careless rapture.
That's perfectly right. I never thought
Browning,
you spoke that much in English, Mr. Kieran. That's fine. Browning's poem called
Home Thoughts from Abroad.
That's perfect. And Mr. Adams, you had your hand up and we'll undoubtedly...
Same thing, but I couldn't have gone as far as that.
Now I'll give you another rapture, gentlemen. Quote, with rapture thrills, close quote. Now what, Dr. Murphy?
The Star-Spangled Banner.
Now, you've got the right country, but the wrong song.
America.
Yes. Now, how about giving us the line in which that phrase occurs?
Well, my heart with rapture thrills like that above.
That's quite right. Yes, I love thy rocks and rills, thy woods and temple hills. How many of us forget the name of the man who wrote America? Mr. Adams, do you remember it?
S.F. Smith.
S.F. Smith.
Fate tried to conceal him by naming him Smith.
Who said that?
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
I thought it was Adams. Samuel Francis Smith, and it's a name that's, of course, very easy to forget. Quote, no minstrel raptures, close quote. Dr. Murphy.
Sir Walter Scott. Breathes there a man with soul so dead who never to himself hath said, this is my own, my native land, whose heart hath ne'er within him burned as home his footsteps he hath turned from...
That's right.
Well, I could go on, but that's enough.
Yes, if such there breathe, go mark him well.
For him no minstrel rap.
That's right.
High though his title, proud his name, etc.
That's the one. That's very good. That gives us 3 raptures out of 3, which is more than enough for this group. Mrs. Eleanor Bowers of Burlington, Maine, wants you to get all 3 of the following. Identify these curious animals. The first is a bird that builds its home with a side door. Mr. Akira.
Well, there are several. Of course, the woodpeckers do, for one thing. Then there's a marsh wren that, the long-billed marsh wren builds. It's not only a home with a side door, but a lot of vacant homes around it with side doors.
Really?
Yeah, very interesting.
Dr. Murphy, you're looking at him.
Confirm it.
That's quite all right.
Quite all right.
All right. Praise from Dr. Murphy is praise indeed. How about an insect that builds a door in its home? An insect that builds a door in its home. Dr. Murphy.
Well, the, of course, a spider does that. Not strictly an insect.
Isn't it a spider is not an insect?
Spider is not an insect.
What is a spider?
Well, it's an arthropod. It belongs to the same larger group that insects do, but it's an 8-legged creature, and all insects are 6-legged.
Good heaven. Mr. Adams, have you learned something? Are those the arachnidae, the spiders?
They are.
Arachnidae.
Perfect.
All right. That's all I wanted to know. It's the only thing I know about a spider is that it's called arachnidae. And now they build doors in their homes?
The trap door spider is so named because it builds a door that opens on a hinge.
Is it concealed or is it...
Concealed. It's sprinkled over the top just like the surface of the ground.
Very
good.
Trap
the unwary.
Mr. Adams?
Canaries have doors in their cages.
I am them.
That is a very touching statement, Mr. Adams. Absolutely true. Certainly. I'll take the canary. Can you, Mr. Adams, tell us about a mammal that has an entrance to its home underwater?
The otter.
The otter. Would that be right, Mr. Kieran?
No, I don't think so, but the Castacanadensis does.
Of course, Mr. Adam knew that all along. Did you know the Castacanadensis?
No, sir, that came to me out of the blue.
Jolly old beaver.
Ah, the beaver, yes.
A muskrat, too. Doesn't have an entrance underwater.
How about this otter friend of Frank's? Is there any chance of that being right?
Well, an otter, of course, can swim under a bank and go up under to his dwelling place therein.
Then he's right.
Yeah, sure. He's
all right, I'd just like to give you a little credit on that, Mr. Adams, the old naturalist. You know, you don't look like Thoreau. That's right. Now, we have a long-billed marsh wren. By the way, you know, you yourself, Mr. Kieran, wrote about the long-billed marsh wren. Must I remind you?
Long while ago,
that's true. Still, you have a good memory. It's in Nature Notes by John Kieran, page 87, in case anybody gets it. All right. Well, how about this one? From Matthew Epstein of Brooklyn, get 2 out of 3. This is about famous... kings, monarchs, gentlemen. What is the dynastic number of each of these monarchs? You know, they're named 1, 2, 3, and so forth. Catherine the Great was what in numerically? Catherine the Great? Mr. Kieran.
I think she was Catherine the First.
No, she was Catherine the Second.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm wrong.
I don't know who was the first Catherine.
You never heard of him.
She's certainly been bedimmed by her successor. Catherine the Second, Empress of Russia, how would you date her? No, I put it a different way, Mr. Kieran.
Very easily.
When did she flourish?
All her life.
All her life, Dr. Murphy. Well, how would you place her? In time, Mr.
Yes. Oh, in the early 1700s, wasn't she?
Well, 1762 to 1796.
Well, I was wrong again.
No, not too far off. Now, Napoleon the Little had a dynastic number, Mr. Brown.
The little Napoleon is Napoleon III.
That's quite right. Who called him Napoleon the Little and why?
Well, there was the little king of Rome came in between.
Well, that's not why...
No, that's Napoleon II, I think.
Yes, that's Napoleon II. Dr. Murphy?
I think it was Thackeray.
I don't think it was. It was a literary man, all right.
Call
Mr. Karen?
Victor Hugo.
Victor Hugo hated them. Hated Napoleon III.
He did it in the History of a Crime, as a matter of fact.
I don't know where, but he referred to him as Napoleon Le Petit all along. Richard the Lion-Hearted had a dynastic number. Dr. Murphy.
Richard the Third.
No, Mr. Kieran?
Richard the First.
He was 1189 to 1199.
Yes. I think you came in just a little too soon on that, Dr. Murphy. You skipped a couple of Richards there. $37 in war bonds to Mr. Epstein and a set of the Britannica. Try this one from Arnold R. Schenck of Chicago. Get 2 out of 3 on this, too. Who, in literature or legend, stole fire from heaven? Stole fire from heaven? Mr. Adams.
Prometheus.
Prometheus, yes. Who, in literature, walked through fire? Walked through fire. This is perhaps in legend. Dr. Murphy?
Dante.
Dante walked through fire?
Yes, before he reached the terrestrial paradise on the near the summit of the Mount of Purgatory, he and Virgil had to walk through fire.
Now, I don't remember that episode. That is a very good answer. I was thinking of Siegfried, who, in the Wagnerian epic, walks through a ring of fire to rescue Brunhilde, all 270 pounds of her. And who was brought back to life by being put into a fire?
Oh.
Mr. Brown.
No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Hansel and Gretel. What happened? The witch turned into gingerbread, didn't she? God only knows.
No, she was just emptied into the... She was burnt up in the oven, wasn't she?
I hope so.
I don't think she was turned into bread, didn't she? Mr. Kieran.
Isn't that in Greek legend at the foundation of the Eleusinian Mysteries?
Now there you have me.
I believe so. Demeter is wandering in search of a daughter. And comes to a house where they are mourning the loss of a child, and she's going to bring the child back to life, and she throws it on the fire, and it upsets the people a great deal, but it eventually turns out all right, because...
And is the child revived?
Yes, and also, the spring comes back, Proserpina comes back to the earth, and that, I believe, is the foundation of the rites of the Eleusinian Mysteries.
He tells a convincing story, doesn't he, Mr. Adams? I'm sure that's right. I was thinking of a somewhat more recent example in Robert W. Service's The Cremation of Sam.
Oh.
Remember that one? Remember it, Mr.
Yeah, Richard? Wonderful. Great poem.
There sat Sam looking cool and calm in the heart of a furnace roar since I left Plum Tree down in Tennessee. It's the first time I've been warm, but I'll take your story of Ceres, which is much more elegant. That gives us 2 out of 3.
So far, so good, Mr. Fadiman. But before your experts tackle the final group of questions, let's relax a bit with some music.
Thank you.
Now, Mrs. George Redfield of New York sends this one in and asks you to get 2 out of 3. Can you name a play by an Englishman about the Hundred Years' War? In which that is Mr. Brown.
The Dynasts by Hardy.
Well, that's about the Napoleon.
Oh, the Napoleon. I beg your pardon. That is...
Thank you.
Was ever this William Shakespeare?
What one?
Shakespeare did write well with War of the Roses, didn't he?
Yes. Henry V is the one you're thinking of. Mr. Kieran, is that the one you were going to mention? A more modern playwright has also written a play about the 100 Years' War. One of your favorite playwrights, Mr. Brown. You saw him not too long ago.
Mr. Shaw.
Yes, what play was that?
This was the Burghers of Calais, was this?
St. Joan.
And St. Joan also,
yes,
too.
Part of the 100 Years' War. A play by an American about the Punic Wars. The Roman Wars, Mr. Adams.
Robert Sherwood's The Road to Rome.
That's perfectly right. Robert Sherwood's The Road to Rome. And a play by an Englishman about the Civil War, about our own Civil War. Mr. Brown again.
Two of them by the same man. By Drinkwater's Lincoln and his Robert E. Lee.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten that John Drinkwater wrote 2 plays about the Civil War or the war between the states, Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. Try this one for Mr. George Wolfe of Chicago. What objects used by our side in the war have been given these proper names? Romeo is something used by us in the war. Mr. Brown.
Well, there happened to be a barrage balloon in London that was called Romeo.
That's right. Why was it so called?
Well, it was always up looking for Juliet.
Isn't it because it was serviced entirely by the Women's Auxiliary Air Forces?
Well, that is the truth, but you put such a hideous meaning on there.
Mr. Kieran?
Is Romeo also was used by a former enemy in this war against us, the Alfa Romeo tank used by the Italians?
That I did not know. How about the Gibson girl? That's an object used by us in the war. What is it? What's a Gibson girl?
The first whack.
You're going awful far back. No, it's apparently a device which sends out automatic distress signals when a plane is forced down over the water. Mr. Brown, in your experience, you had never heard that phrase? Long Tom would mean what, Dr. Murphy?
Well, that's the very long-barreled howitzer.
Mr. Kieran?
No, it's not a howitzer. It's a rifle. It's either 150 or 155 millimeter rifle.
Yes, a 155-millimeter gun. That's quite right. That gives us 2 out of 3 and sends us on to this one from Corporal Jackson, care of Postmaster New York. Get 2 out of 3. Quote a line of poetry that mentions the insignia of a second lieutenant. Any line of poetry mention the insignia of a second lieutenant? Mr. Kieran.
The blessed damozel leaned out from the golden bar at even.
That's wonderful. One that mentions the insignia of a brigadier general. Insignia of a brigadier general. Mr. Adams.
Fair as a star when only one is shining in the sky.
That's perfect, Mr. Adams. And a line of poetry that mentions the insignia of a major. Insignia of a major. Perhaps that's a little tougher. Mr. Kieran.
And leaf and oak and leaf and fruit were as gold and fire, and the oak was heard above the lyre, and the chestnut and the hoofed heel of a satyr crushed the chestnut husk at the chestnut root.
Hey,
gold leaf, major.
Fun.
That's from Keats. Greek chorus from Caledon. Atalanta and Caledon.
Swinburne. Anyone care to cap that? There is another one mentioning a yellow leaf, Mr. Kieran.
Well, that's a gold leaf. Not a yellow leaf.
And yellow leaf.
Yeah, that isn't a gold leaf.
That's from Macbeth.
No. That's from Macbeth. And doubtless you could give us the act and scene.
And then there's the maple leaf. Forever, isn't it?
Yes. That would, of course, be true.
That's not a maple leaf on a major shoulder. That's an oak leaf.
That's an oak leaf. That's quite true. What is the insignia of the next higher grade of
Lieutenant General? Is silver oak leaf.
Is a silver leaf. That's quite right. That gives us 3 out of 3, and that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Dr. Murphy. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for coming up to the party this evening.
This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.